You're listening to the sound of the buffy-headed marmoset, a forest-dwelling primate from the Atlantic Forest in southeast Brazil, recorded by Douglas Quinn. If we were to travel several thousand miles northwest, we'd reach the Yasuni National Park in Ecuador. The park is part of the Amazon rainforest that was declared a UNESCO World Biosphere Reserve in 1989. And one group of scientists in 2004 declared it to be the most biodiverse region in the world. The forest is also home to three groups of indigenous peoples, the Tagayeri, the Taromenani, and the Onyamenani, who voluntarily maintain no contact with the outside world. They have been described by fellow Ecuadorians as, quote, the last free beings in Ecuador, true warriors who live in what are described as societies of abundance because they produce just enough to satisfy their needs, unquote. It might be blessed with riches in abundance above ground, but below ground, Ecuador is a country that is cursed with reserves of oil, and its economy has become dependent on the black stuff. In other parts of the country, oil extraction has left a toxic legacy and a wake of environmental devastation. And yet, despite the various legal protections afforded to the Yasuni National Park, there is mounting pressure to drill here too. In 2007, a new president took office in Ecuador, Rafael Correa. Within a few months, he had made an offer to the world that he would not drill in the Yasuni National Park if the international community paid the country compensation worth just half of what the country would otherwise earn from oil revenues. Left-leaning presidents like Correa usually make a priority of renegotiating contracts with foreign oil companies in order to secure greater amounts of oil revenues for the development of their country, or even take back the country's oil operations and turn them into nationalised industries. Correa's proposal brings in a new perspective that recognises our global need for climate protection, as well as the needs of his own indigenous populations. This week, on the 300 to 350 show, we take a look at this proposal and speculate on its wider significance. In the UK, a campaign called Yasuni Green Gold has started up to champion and publicise the proposal. One of the first things they've done is to produce a book of photographs of the park, which they have been asking people to purchase and to donate to a decision maker of their choice. I spoke to Georgina Donati, one of the campaign team, and a co-author of the Yasuni Green Gold book.
It might be good to start with to outline what the scheme is, what the proposal is, in its kind of simplest form.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll give you a bit of background to the area first. The Yasuni is in the Ecuadorian Amazon. It's a national park protected by UNESCO and is considered to be one of the most biodiverse places in the world. For example, one hectare in the Yasuni has more different species of trees than in the whole of North America. And it's also got various different indigenous groups in it, including some who maintain voluntarily no contact with the outside world. And so basically they discovered approximately 500 million barrels of oil underneath the centre of the park a couple of years ago, and which is considered to be the largest reserve that Ecuador's got. And last year in May, President Correa basically said that he was prepared not to exploit the oil underneath these reserves in return for half the amount of money that he would have got from exploiting the oil, which is $350 million. Annually for the next 10 years. And he was asking for this from the international community, that be government, organisations, individuals, whoever was prepared to support them to do this so that they could move into more of a non-carbon economy, because currently Ecuador relies on oil heavily for the country's economy.
I mean, it seems to have enormous benefits, this project. Perhaps we can just run through them.
Yeah, I mean, the area currently, there's a lot of oil exploitation going on in the region, and I mean, it's incredibly damaging environmentally, as you can imagine, with oil spills, for example, in the province of Oriana, which is where the Yasuni lies. There's been 800 oil spills since exploitation began that haven't been cleared up, which, you know, leads to illnesses, which leads to contamination of rivers, of soils, of the animals that people hunt, of the crops that people eat.
And it's much more important, presumably, because people are so directly reliant on the land.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, exactly. The water that they would fish in is contaminated, that they bathe in is contaminated, that they drink, you know, the soil otherwise that they would grow their crops in is completely concentrated in with oil. And animals as well are poisoned, which they would hunt, as well as domestic animals who drink also from the rivers and things like that. So, I mean, it affects them every way they turn.
So it would avoid that. It would protect what is an intentionally rich area of biodiversity. Why is it so biologically diverse?
Well, there haven't been, as far as I know, a huge amount of scientific studies into the area, but they basically think that in the last ice age it didn't freeze over, and therefore it became a refuge for animals and plants, which then eventually repopulated the rest of the Amazon. So they believe it to be a concentrated area of endemic species, which you can't find in other places for this reason.
Right, I mean, I had a look on the map last night, and it's right on the equator, so presumably it would have been the warmest place, one of the warmest places around the time of the last ice age.
Yeah.
It would also protect the indigenous peoples and their right to be left to live in peace on the land.
Exactly.
Stop the oil being exploited and contributing to climate change, and protect the rainforest, which would also, if lost, would contribute to climate change. I mean, there, that's about, you know, five major benefits.
Yeah.
So obviously, it works out for the Ecuadorian government because they get a certain amount of compensation, although not as much revenue as they would if they would exploit the field for oil.
Mm.
But I mean, what's in it for the international community?
Is it
a good deal? I mean, no, it's a terrible way of putting it, but I mean, all these things are kind of now. That's the way these things are kind of conceptualised, I guess.
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, I think there are a couple of points. One is that, you know, this goes towards fighting against climate change, which is one of the big buzzwords at the moment, in two ways. It's avoiding deforestation, and it's also avoiding further burning of fossil fuels by not extracting them in the first place. So that benefits the global environment in two ways. And also, there's so much money and so many schemes being planned out as to how we're going to be combating climate change, and this just seems like the most obvious way at the moment, as opposed to planting trees on one side of the world to offset carbon emissions on the other side of the world. Why don't you stop emitting and stop cutting down these trees in this really important area? So I mean, I think it's definitely beneficial for the world as a whole.
I mean, it seems to be in opposition to the talks that are going on at the moment at the UN level, which is about including forestation and issues around forests into the global carbon markets, which, I mean, they're just kind of ridden with problems.
Mm.
Are you able to talk about the problems that are foreseen with the idea of including forests in the carbon markets?
Well, I can relay some local concerns. The local concerns have been basically that if we really want to tackle climate change, then we have to take it on in both ways. We can't just avoid deforestation. We've also got to take a sort of a two-pronged attack and avoid burning further fossil fuels, which is why this Yasuni idea is so much better than just the red talks, which are concerned around stopping deforestation. They're also concerned locally about entering into carbon trading, which they feel to be and, you know, another big business which is out of their control and which then comes in and aims to take over their lives and their land and things like that. So I think that those locally are quite big concerns.
So in the Ecuadorian proposal, how would the money be raised? Who would pay?
Well, I think there are a few problems at the moment with the Ecuadorian proposal, mainly because, I mean, it's almost like a first draft of a proposal, and so it needs still a lot of work. So, for example, there don't seem to be any clear plans as to where the money's going to be going. So although they've invited anybody in the international community to contribute, I mean, individuals can pay to, they have one scheme which seems to be pay to keep a barrel of oil under the soil and up to organisations and governments. But there doesn't seem to be a clear idea as to where this money is going to be going, which is concerning the local people, as it would be concerning those putting their money into the plan as well. And so what we're asking for is these clear plans, also guarantees that if, you know, once this money goes in, then that will be preserving the Yasuni and it will be protecting the local people, and to include further participation as well of the local people who so far haven't been involved in this proposal.
I mean, the idea is that the money raised would kind of go into a fund, and then, as I understand it, the interest on that would be used by the Ecuadorian state for various kind of social and environmental projects. But you're saying there's basically not enough detail around that yet?
I think, yeah, it's not particularly transparent. Ideas are coming out like that, which are good ideas, but they haven't properly been planned out, and they haven't been, as far as I can tell, as particularly what the government has told the international community. They haven't been properly planned out as to how these are going to work, and, you know, where the money's going to be going, and how this is actually going to support the preservation of the Yasuni, because obviously this is one of the concerns that you're going into to support the sustainable preservation of the area as well, so that it doesn't come up against a similar threat in, you know, in 5-10 years' time.
Yeah. To what extent has this proposal been developed by civil society, campaign groups and the local people? And to what extent, I mean, it seemed to get taken up very quickly by the president. So is it happening at both levels? Is there kind of an interplay between the two, do you think? Or?
Well, the proposal started in social and environmental movements in Ecuador, and then it was taken on by the government, which have a very sort of socially progressive environmental section to it, and then it has another section which is, you know, sort of trying to get on in the neoliberal market. And so at the beginning there was a lot of support for these kinds of initiatives, and I think as time has gone on and there hasn't been much development of the proposal in order to entice the international community in to really support it, the other part of the government has sort of been gaining a bit more ground, and this is losing out a little bit of the proposal. So although social organisations have been very much involved in the development of it, I think they're starting to lose their influence in the proposal at the moment.
Right, okay. So what kind of support has the proposal been getting? Has it been taken up by other groups? I mean, is this kind of alternative approach something that people are kind of thinking more widely about? And what about support from national governments and NGOs and stuff as well?
There has been interest for the proposal internationally. I mean, from governments like Norway, from Germany, Italy, Spain. A lot of them have, you know, also had similar concerns that they don't feel like it's developed enough, or they don't see that there are clear enough guarantees for the Yasuni, for its people. And so, for example, the German government actually officially responded saying that they would like clarification of certain issues, which is really positive, and asked for the extension of the deadline, which is one of, you know, the main concerns of the local people and organisations who are also working towards preservation of the Yasuni, that there's suddenly this deadline in December where, you know, there will be money or there will be drilling.
Right.
So it has sparked a lot of inspiration around the world that, oh, look, this is an amazing possibility for everybody, really. But I think the movement on both sides, the movement of the Ecuadorian government really developing the proposal and the movement of the international really pushing for them to develop it so that they can, you know, create something together, hasn't been happening enough.
What do you think the next kind of stage is for this? Where do you think this is all going to go from here?
Well, Korea has asked for a response from the international community, and that's the international community as a whole. So governments, organisations, individuals, and what we're trying to do at the moment is give him a response and say, you know, in a kind of united voice, look, we think this is a brilliant initiative. You know, this has the potential to be quite revolutionary in some ways, keeping the oil underground and preserving this pristine environment. But you have to make this proposal better. You've got to improve it. You've got to give us guarantees. You've got to tell us exactly where the money is going to go. And you've got to include local people in this. And so I think the idea is at the moment Korea is saying that, okay, there hasn't been enough international interest. There's nothing I can do. I'm just going to have to go ahead and drill it. And so I think the idea at the moment is to say, no, hang on a sec, there is international interest. You can't just go ahead with it because nobody cares, because we do care and we do want it to go forward. It's just that you have to come now again with us halfway and say, these are the ways you're going to improve on the proposal. this is what we're looking to happen at the moment.
I mean, Oil Watch seems to have been doing some work on it. Are they moving forward on the detail? Is that one way it can be progressed?
I'm not familiar with what Oil Watch are doing at the moment, actually. I know that before they were quite involved with the government proposal, and as the Yasuni Green Gold campaign is a local campaign, we were trying to give more of the local perspective about how the proposal could be improved. So I think like Oil Watch has the potential, is such an influential organisation. I'm not familiar with what they're doing at the moment. Perhaps they are also sort of pushing forward these sorts of issues, such as guarantees and plans for where the money's going, local involvement.
I guess the big danger, as we say, is there is a lot of momentum to include, and it's on the agenda for the UN talks in December, to include forests in the carbon market. Will the Yasuni campaign be able to put up a presence at the talks and try and put that alternative view forward?
As I understand, at the moment they're taking different projects as different examples of how they could possibly go forward post-Kyoto. And so we are proposing that maybe that Yasuni could be one of these examples, could be a way to look at a different model away from the Kyoto carbon trading model. And so we are presenting that this could be an alternative that could work in a much, much more successfully than we've seen so far, the carbon market working.
That was Georgina Donati of the Yasuni Green Gold Campaign. The impacts of oil exploration are well known by the communities that live alongside oil extraction. As this programme is finalised, Shell are being taken to court yet again for their work in Nigeria. This time communities from the Niger Delta are filing a lawsuit in The Hague, accusing Shell of negligence. According to Friends of the Earth, Shell's oil production in Nigeria results in an average of 5 oil spills per week, leaving local soil and water resources unfit for agriculture and fishing. It's the same in Ecuador. Local people have summarised the impacts of oil production on their country as follows. Pollution, deforestation, alteration of ecological relations in ecosystems, economic dependency, high costs of security, social breakdown including alcoholism, violence, prostitution and disease, increasing conflicts and cross-border violence, degradation of the lives of local peoples, and cultural extinction. It's no wonder oil has been called the devil's excrement. So could President Rafael Correa's proposal provide a way forward for some communities that are currently protected, but who could be threatened by oil extraction activities in the future? In September 2007, Correa took the proposal to the UN General Assembly. And in December last year, Oil Watch, which describes itself as a, quote, resistance network that opposes the activities of oil companies in tropical countries, unquote, put together a collection of writings called Keep Oil Underground, which explored the possible wider application of the Yasuni proposal. It was felt that there was scope for something similar to work in countries such as East Timor, Mauritania, Bolivia, Indonesia, and Nigeria. The Oil Watch Network has been amongst those civil society players in the Global South that have been developing the idea of ecological debt. Jubilee South is another of those players. Here, in a position paper from 2005, they explain the concept. This summit, they write, provides us with an opportunity to change the power relationships and, from a position of creditors, demand the cancellation of illegitimate, inhumane and immoral foreign debts. Stop the pillaging of natural resources, the destruction, contamination of nature and the violation of human rights. Prevent the growth of foreign social ecological debts and demand environmental restoration and remediation of the impacts suffered by the victims. We're going to end the programme with Naomi Klein, speaking in London earlier this year about the Yasuni proposal and its relationship to the idea of ecological debt. The first extract is from the lecture she gave at the launch of the paperback edition of her book, The Shock Doctrine, and the second extract is from an interview with Gail Garcia Bernal of Resist Network that took place the following day. Thanks for listening.
last week and doing some research and watching the Spanish edition of the book. And, you know, Ecuador is certainly part of this Latin American shift to the left. They elected a left-wing president named Rafael Correa a couple years ago, who's shutting down the U.S. military base. He says the U.S. can't have a military base in Ecuador unless Ecuador can have a military base in Miami, and that's not flying, so they're kicking him out. One of the first things Rafael Correa said when he was elected, they said, what's your economic project? And he said, well, let's put it this way, I'm no fan of Milton Friedman's. And, you know, his vision was a classic developmentalist position in Latin America. And his big fight before he was elected president was there's a pipeline being built through parts of the Amazon. It was being pushed with World Bank money. And Rafael Correa, when he was economics minister, had wanted a certain percentage of the revenue from the pipeline to go to health, to be earmarked for healthcare and education in Ecuador, which is a great idea, and which was promptly nixed by the World Bank. And the government has been at loggerheads with the bank since Correa took office. But what's interesting about what's going on in Ecuador right now is that Correa is being pushed by much more radical elements of society, many of them from indigenous groups. Ecuador has the largest indigenous federation in Latin America called CONAIE. And CONAIE is leading a campaign to leave the oil in the ground in the Amazon, which is a more radical demand than the demand of extracting it, but holding on to a greater percentage of the profits. And of course, they're arguing that the pipeline is a threat to their way of life. And they're also arguing that the Amazon is it belongs to all of humanity, and that there are more species in one hectare of this part of the world than there are species in North America, and that it must be protected. But Correa's demand that a percentage of the profits go to healthcare and education is also an eminently reasonable demand for a country that has been looted for so many years. And so what people in Ecuador are pushing right now is the concept of ecological debt, which is that people in wealthy countries like ours who have contributed so much to climate change, can't just demand that countries like Ecuador leave their oil in the ground because we want to visit the Amazon someday, but should pay them not to develop the Amazon and leave the oil in the ground. So they're really developing a new model, a model that needs our support. And so what that means, I think, is working to make the concept of ecological debt, which is so much better a concept than carbon trading, the social justice issue of our time, because it marries together these two most pressing issues of climate change and economic justice.
What I found interesting last night about Ecuador,
yeah.
So they're actually asking to be paid to not extract the oil.
Yes.
Okay.
In the Yasuni National Park.
And that's like a whole, for me, like a whole new way of framing issues that surround
this. It says that countries that have been cast as debtors are actually creditors, right?
Mm-hmm.
And creditors on many, many fronts, from, you know, earlier extraction, from debts that were recovered, that were odious debts and should never have been recovered. And then a climate debt that is owed, well, to Andean countries that are on the front lines of climate change and that are living the effects of climate change firsthand. So we owe all of these debts and a debt because these countries are paying a higher price for emissions that they themselves did not produce.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a whole other way of doing math. It's a whole other way of thinking about economics that I think is actually quite radicalizing. It doesn't sound like that radical idea, but once you start making these calculations, yeah, you're actually talking about everything. You're talking about colonialism,
yeah,
you're talking about a history of debt, you're talking about a history of resource extraction, and you're talking about climate change.
Yeah.
And how far evolved is that? Is this like, are we at the early stages of that? Or is, I mean, I heard expressions.
You should talk
like,
to Marlon Santi. He's the new head of CONAI, which is the most powerful indigenous federation in the world.
Yeah.
And he's very young, wise beyond his years. He's only, I think he's only 32. And he's definitely the youngest head of CONAI ever. I think what's interesting about what Marlon Santi is doing is that CONAI has gone, you know, they've gone into government, they have held the balance of power in the Gutierrez government, they've made mistakes, and they now recognize it as mistakes, and they've made a decision that they want to be a counter force, articulating this other world view rather than making deals in government.
Yeah.
And he really represents this new era, or a return to an earlier era, fighting era for CONAI, because he comes out of the struggles for the Amazon.
Do you think there are other examples of that fight taking place around the world, or do you think this is like a kind of fresh resurgence?
Oh, these battles are happening everywhere.
But politicizing it in a way that is framed under, let's say, the term ecological debt, or branded in that way, in the most positive sense of the word.
Not on the scale, but it is, yeah. But I'm only just starting to learn about it, and it's challenging some of my own writing and thinking, because it does challenge left and right. Because and this tension between Correa and CONAI, you know, it brings it to a head, because he's much more of a traditional Marxist academic. You know, that's who he is, and he's coming in saying, okay, we want a better deal.
Yeah.
We want a new deal. And he's not necessarily challenging the logic of extraction. He's challenging how much Ecuador gets to keep, and that's fair.
Yeah.
But it can't go on forever. And it also comes at a tremendous price and puts him into direct conflict with indigenous communities in Ecuador.
So supposedly he was on the same side of up until that
moment.
But
they're actually having the debate. I find it really inspiring.
Yeah.